As we tighten the control over our dreams, we tighten the mastery over our dreaming attention. The dreaming attention comes into play when it is called, when it is given a purpose. Its coming into play is not really a process, as one would normally understand a process. That is, as an ongoing system of operations or a series of actions or functions that bring about an end result. It is rather an awakening. Something dormant becomes suddenly functional. A dreaming teacher must create a didactic synthesis in order to emphasize a given point. In essence, what I wanted with your first task was to exercise your dreaming attention by focusing it on the items of your dreams. To this effect, I used as a spearhead the idea of being aware of falling asleep. My subterfuge was to say that the only way to be aware of falling asleep is to examine the elements of one's dreams. Exercising the dreaming attention is the essential point in dreaming. To the mind, however, it seems impossible that one can train oneself to be aware at the level of dreams. The active element of such training is persistence. The mind and all its rational defenses cannot cope with persistence. Sooner or later, the mind's barriers fall under its impact, and the dreaming attention blooms. As you practice focusing and holding your dreaming attention on the items of your dreams, you are entering into the second attention. This calls for even more sobriety on your part. Go slowly, but don't stop, and above all, don't talk about it. Just do it. If one takes short glances at everything in a dream, the images do not dissolve. The difficult part is to break the initial barrier that prevents us from bringing dreams to our conscious attention. This barrier is, in part, a psychological one created by our socialization, which puts a premium on disregarding dreams. But the barrier is more than socialization. It's the first gate of dreaming. The first gate of dreaming has to do with the flow of energy in the universe. It's a natural obstacle. The energy needed to release our dreaming attention from its socialization prison comes from redeploying our existing energy. The emergence of our dreaming attention is a direct corollary of revamping our lives. Since we have no way to plug into an external source for a boost of energy, we must redeploy our existing energy by any means available. The sorcerer's way is the best means to oil, so to speak, the wheels of energy redeployment. Of all the items in the sorcerer's way, the most effective is losing self-importance. This is indispensable for everything sorcerers do, and for this reason I put an enormous emphasis on guiding all my students to fulfill this requirement. Self-importance is not only the sorcerer's supreme enemy, but the nemesis of mankind. Most of our energy goes into upholding our importance. This is most obvious in our endless worry about the presentation of the self, about whether or not we are admired or liked or acknowledged. If we are capable of losing some of that importance, two extraordinary things happen to us. One, we free our energy from trying to maintain the illusory idea of our grandeur, and two, we provide ourselves with enough energy to enter into the second attention to catch a glimpse of the actual grandeur of the universe. The capability of examining the contents of one's dreams is the product of a natural configuration of our being. We are not alone in this world. There are other worlds available to dreamers, total worlds. From those other total worlds, energetic entities sometimes come to us. You can't explain dreaming by way of things you know or suspect you know. Believe me, the most extravagant feature of sorcery is that configuration called out of this world. You reach the second gate of dreaming when you wake up from a dream into another dream. You can have as many dreams as you want, or as many as you are capable of, but you must exercise adequate control and not wake up in the world we know. I'm not saying that you should never wake up in this world, but I have to tell you that that is an alternative. The sorcerers of antiquity used to do that, never wake up in the world we know. It certainly can be done, but I don't recommend it. What I want is for you to wake up naturally when you are through with dreaming. But while you are dreaming, I want you to dream that you wake up in another dream. This control is no different from the control we have over any situation in our daily lives. There's one problem with the second gate. It's a problem that can be serious, depending on one's bent of character. If our tendency is to indulge in clinging to things or situations, we are in for a sock in the jaw. Imagine yourself going from dream to dream, watching everything, examining every detail. It's very easy to realize that one may sink to mortal depths, especially if one is given to indulging. Wouldn't the body or the brain naturally put a stop to it? Yes, if it's a natural sleeping situation, meaning normal. But this is not a normal situation. This is dreaming. A dreamer, on crossing the first gate, has already reached the energy body. So what is really going through the second gate, hopping from dream to dream, is the energy body. The implication is that, on crossing the second gate, you must intend a greater and more sober control over your dreaming attention, the only safety valve for dreamers. You will find out for yourself that the true goal of dreaming is to perfect the energy body. A perfect energy body, among other things, of course, has such a control over the dreaming attention that it makes it stop when needed. This is the safety valve dreamers have. No matter how indulging they might be, at a given time, their dreaming attention must make them surface. Crossing the second gate is a very serious affair. It requires a most disciplined effort. I told you that one has to wake up in another dream, but what I meant is that one has to change dreams in an orderly and precise manner. There are two ways of properly crossing the second gate of dreaming. One is to wake up in another dream, that is to say, to dream that one is having a dream and then dream that one wakes up from it. The alternative is to use the items of a dream to trigger another dream, that is, zoom from a definite item accessible to your immediate dreaming attention to another one not quite accessible, or gaze at any item of a dream, maintaining the gaze until the item changes shape and, by changing shape, pulls you into another dream. Life and consciousness, being exclusively a matter of energy, are not solely the property of organisms. Sorcerers have seen that there are two types of conscious beings roaming the earth, the organic and the inorganic. In comparing one with the other, they have seen that both are luminous masses crossed from every imaginable angle by millions of the universe's energy filaments. They are different from each other in their shape and in their degree of brightness. Inorganic beings are long and candle-like but opaque, whereas organic beings are round and by far the brighter. Another noteworthy difference sorcerers have seen is that the life and consciousness of organic beings is short-lived because they are made to hurry, whereas the life of inorganic beings is infinitely longer and their consciousness infinitely more calm and deeper. Sorcerers find no problem interacting with them. Inorganic beings possess the crucial ingredient for interaction, consciousness. For sorcerers, having life means having consciousness. It means having an assemblage point in its surrounding glow of awareness, a condition that points out to sorcerers that the being in front of them, organic or inorganic, is thoroughly capable of perceiving. Perceiving is understood by sorcerers as the precondition of being alive. The inorganic beings must also die. They lose their awareness just like we do, except that the length of their consciousness is staggering to the mind. It's very difficult to tell what is what with them. Let's say that those beings are enticed by us, or better yet, compelled to interact with us. The proper thing to do is to suspend judgment and let things take their course, meaning that you let the inorganic beings come to you. The difficulty with inorganic beings is that their awareness is very slow in comparison with ours. It will take years for a sorcerer to be acknowledged by inorganic beings. So it is advisable to have patience and wait. Sooner or later, they show up, but not like you or I would show up. Theirs is a most peculiar way of making themselves known. Sorcerers entice them in dreaming. What's involved, though, is more than enticing them. By the act of dreaming, sorcerers compel those beings to interact with them. Dreaming is sustaining the position where the assemblage point has shifted in dreams. This act creates a distinctive energy charge which attracts their attention. It's like bait to fish. They'll go for it. Sorcerers, by reaching and crossing the first two gates of dreaming, set bait for those beings and compel them to appear. By going through the two gates, you make your bidding known to them. Then, you must wait for a sign from them, possibly the appearance of one of them, or simply some interference in your dreaming. You must gauge your expectations. Our normal expectation when engaging in interaction with our fellow men or with other organic beings is to get an immediate reply to our solicitation. With inorganic beings, however, since they are separated from us by a most formidable barrier, energy that moves at a different speed, sorcerers must gauge their expectations and sustain the solicitation for as long as it takes to be acknowledged. The solicitation is the same as the dreaming practices. But for a perfect result, you must add to your practices the intent of reaching those inorganic beings. Send a feeling of power and confidence to them, a feeling of strength, of detachment. Avoid at any cost sending a feeling of fear or morbidity. They are pretty morbid by themselves, and to add your morbidity to them is unnecessary, to say the least. They do at times materialize themselves in the daily world right in front of us. Most of the time, though, their invisible presence is marked by a bodily jolt, a shiver of sorts that comes from the marrow of the bones. In dreaming, we have the total opposite. At times, we feel them as a jolt of fear. Most of the time, they materialize themselves right in front of us. Since at the beginning of dreaming, we have no experience whatsoever with them, they might imbue us with fear beyond measure. This is a real danger to us. Through the channel of fear, they can follow us to the daily world, with disastrous results for us. Fear can settle down in our lives, and we would have to be mavericks to deal with it. Inorganic beings can be worse than a pest. Through fear, they can easily drive us raving mad. What sorcerers do with inorganic beings is mingle with them. They turn them into allies. They form associations, create extraordinary friendships. I call them vast enterprises, where perception plays the uppermost role. We are social beings. We unavoidably seek the company of consciousness. With inorganic beings, the secret is not to fear them. And this must be done from the beginning. The intent one has to send out to them has to be of power and abandon. In that intent, one must encode the message, I don't fear you. Come to see me. If you do, I'll welcome you. If you don't want to come, I'll miss you. With a message like this, they'll get so curious that they'll come for sure. Why should they come to seek you, or why on earth should you seek them? Dreamers, whether they like it or not, in their dreaming seek associations with other beings. This may come to you as a shock, but dreamers automatically seek groups of beings, nexuses of inorganic beings in this case. Dreamers seek them avidly. Why would dreamers do that? The novelty for us is the inorganic beings, and the novelty for them is one of our kind crossing the boundaries of their realm. The thing you must bear in mind from now on is that inorganic beings with their superb consciousness exert a tremendous pull over dreamers and can easily transport them into worlds beyond description. The sorcerers of antiquity used them, and they are the ones who coined the name allies. Their allies taught them to move the assemblage point out of the egg's boundaries into the non-human universe. So when they transport a sorcerer, they transport him to worlds beyond the human domain. Think about dreaming in these terms. Dreaming is perceiving more than what we believe it is possible to perceive. The second attention is available to all of us, but by willfully holding on to our half-cocked rationality, some of us more fiercely than others, we keep the second attention at arm's length. Dreaming brings down the barriers that surround and insulate the second attention. If the inorganic beings single a dreamer out by reappearing over and over in his dreaming, it means that they seek an association. I've mentioned to you that sorcerers form bonds of friendship with them. Such a friendship consists of a mutual exchange of energy. The inorganic beings supply their high awareness, and sorcerers supply their heightened awareness and high energy. The positive result is an even exchange. The negative one is dependency on both parties. Once they have singled a dreamer out the dreamer can summon them in his normal daily awareness, size them up, and then decide himself what to do. You summon them by holding your dream view of them in your mind. The reason they would saturate a dreamer with their presence in his dreams is that they want to create a memory of their shape in his mind. You can then use that memory by closing your eyes and visualizing their shape until they are just like they are in your dreams. When you have them in focus, open your eyes, then get up and grab one of them and don't let go, no matter how it shakes you. You drop it and you're done for. If you feel the inorganic being's energy like water, you're not going to have helping friends among the inorganic beings, but relationships of annoying dependency. Be, in that case, extremely careful. Watery inorganic beings are more given to excesses. The old sorcerers believed that they were more loving, more capable of imitating, or perhaps even having feelings, as opposed to the other kind, the fiery ones, who were thought to be more serious, more contained than the others, but also more pompous. My recommendation is that you vanquish fear from your dreams and from your life in order to safeguard your unity. In matters of the inorganic beings, I am nearly a novice. I refused that part of the sorcerer's knowledge on the ground that it is too cumbersome and capricious. I don't want to be at the mercy of any entity, organic or inorganic. By means of their dreaming contacts with inorganic beings, the old sorcerers became immensely well-versed in the manipulation of the assemblage point, a vast and ominous subject. The inorganic beings have never been my cup of tea. My reason for that is the best reason in the world. We are antithetical. They love slavery and I love freedom. They love to buy and I don't sell. The best thing to do with inorganic beings is deny their existence, but visit with them regularly and maintain that you are dreaming, and in dreaming anything is possible. This way you don't commit yourself. If one is to accept that inorganic beings are as real as people, where in the physicality of the universe is the realm in which they exist? That realm exists in a particular position of the assemblage point, just like our world exists in the habitual position of the assemblage point. Upon crossing the first or second gate of dreaming, dreamers reach a threshold of energy and begin to see things or to hear voices. Not really plural voices, but a singular voice. Sorcerers call it the voice of the dreaming emissary. The dreaming emissary is alien energy that has conciseness. Alien energy that purports to aid dreamers by telling them things. The problem with the dreaming emissary is that it can only tell what the sorcerers already know or should know, were they worth their salt. It's alien energy, an impersonal force that we turn into a very personal one because it has a voice. Some sorcerers swear by it. They even see it. We see it or hear it because we maintain our assemblage point fixed on a specific new position. The more intense this fixation, the more intense our experience of the emissary. This force is capable of materializing itself. It all depends on how fixed the assemblage point is, but rest assured, if you are capable of maintaining a degree of detachment, nothing happens. The emissary remains what it is, an impersonal force that acts on us because of the fixation of our assemblage points. Is its advice safe and sound? It cannot be advice. It only tells us what's what. And then, we draw the inferences ourselves. It's just like I said, the emissary doesn't tell you anything new. Its statements are correct, but it only seems to be revealing things to you. What the emissary does is merely repeat what you already know. You know now infinitely more about the mystery of the universe than what you rationally suspect. But that's our human malady. To know more about the mystery of the universe than we suspect. The emissary tells me things I focus my intent on, things I don't want to take the trouble to follow up myself. Let's say that the dreaming emissary is a force that comes from the realm of inorganic beings. This is the reason dreamers always encounter it. Every dreamer hears or sees the emissary, though very few feel it. I don't have any explanation for this. Besides, I don't really care about the emissary. At one point in my life, I had to make a decision whether to concentrate on the inorganic beings and follow in the footsteps of the old sorcerers, or to refuse it all. My teacher helped me make up my mind to refuse it. I've never regretted that decision. The whole realm of inorganic beings is always poised to teach, perhaps because inorganic beings have a deeper consciousness than ours. They feel compelled to take us under their wings. I didn't see any point in becoming their pupil. Their price is too high. Their price is our lives, our energy, our devotion to them. In other words, our freedom. They teach things pertinent to their world, the same way we ourselves would teach them, if we were capable of teaching them, things pertinent to our world. Their method, however, is to take our basic self as a gauge of what we need and then teach us accordingly. A most dangerous affair. If someone was going to take your basic self as a gauge, with all your fears and greed and envy, etc., etc., and teach you what fulfills that horrible state of being, what do you think the result would be? The problem with the old sorcerers was that they learned wonderful things, but on the basis of their unadulterated lower selves. The inorganic beings became their allies, and by means of deliberate examples, they taught the old sorcerers marvels. Their allies performed the actions, and the old sorcerers were guided step by step to copy those actions without changing anything about their basic nature. Involvements of this nature curtail our search for freedom by consuming all our available energy. If a sorcerer wants to live in the realm of the inorganic beings, the emissary is the perfect bridge. It speaks, and its bent is to teach, to guide. I neither approve of that realm nor like it. It belongs to another mood, the old sorcerer's mood. Besides, its teachings and guidance in our world are nonsense, and for that nonsense, the emissary charges us enormities in terms of energy. Just because we haven't been taught to emphasize dreams as a genuine field for exploration doesn't mean that they are not one. Dreams are analyzed for their meaning or are taken as portents, but never are they taken as a realm of real events. To my knowledge, only the old sorcerers did that, but at the end they flubbed it, they got greedy, and when they came to a crucial crossroads, they took the wrong fork. They put all their eggs in one basket, the fixation of the assemblage point on the thousands of positions it can adopt. Out of all the marvelous things the old sorcerers learned exploring those thousands of positions, only the art of dreaming and the art of stalking remain. The art of dreaming is concerned with the displacement of the assemblage point. Stalking is the art that deals with the fixation of the assemblage point on any location to which it is displaced. To fixate the assemblage point on any new spot means to acquire cohesion. An apprentice does just that in his dreaming practices. He is perfecting his energy body. He is doing that and much more. He is learning to have cohesion. Dreaming does it by forcing dreamers to fixate the assemblage point. The dreaming attention, the energy body, the second attention, the relationship with inorganic beings, the dreaming emissary, are but byproducts of acquiring cohesion. In other words, they are all byproducts of fixating the assemblage point on a number of dreaming positions. A dreaming position is any new position to which the assemblage point has been displaced during sleep. We fixate the assemblage point on a dreaming position by sustaining the view of any item in our dreams, or by changing dreams at will. Through his dreaming practices, an apprentice is really exercising his capacity to be cohesive. That is to say, he is exercising his capacity to maintain a new energy shape by holding the assemblage point fixed on the position of any particular dream he is having. While exercising his capacity to maintain a new energy shape, he isn't really maintaining a new energy shape yet, not exactly, and not because he can't, but only because he is shifting the assemblage point instead of moving it. Shifts of the assemblage point give rise to minute changes, which are practically unnoticeable. The challenge of shifts is that they are so small and so numerous that to maintain cohesiveness in all of them is a triumph. We know we are maintaining cohesion by the clarity of our perception. The clearer the view of our dreams, the greater our cohesion. I'm going to tell you about a practical application of what an apprentice learns in dreaming. He focuses his attention, as if he is in a dream, on the foliage of a tree. He doesn't just gaze at it, he does something very special with the foliage. Remember, I've said that in dreaming, once you're able to hold the view of any item, you are really holding the dreaming position of your assemblage point. So then, an apprentice gazes at the leaves of a tree as if he is in a dream, but with a slight yet most meaningful variation. He holds his dreaming attention on the leaves of the tree in the awareness of our daily world. By staring at the foliage, he accomplishes a minute displacement of his assemblage point. Then, by summoning his dreaming attention through staring at individual leaves, he actually fixates that minute displacement, and his cohesion makes him perceive in terms of the second attention. The process is so simple, it is ridiculous. Our speech faculty is extremely flimsy, and attacks of muteness are common among sorcerers who venture this way beyond the limits of normal perception. It is not possible for one to rely on one's rationality to understand such an experience as summoning one's dreaming attention through staring at individual leaves, not because our rationality is in any way impaired, but because what takes place is a phenomenon outside the parameters of reason. Reason is only a byproduct of the habitual position of the assemblage point. Therefore, knowing what is going on, being of sound mind, having our feet on the ground, sources of great pride to us, and assumed to be a natural consequence of our worth, are merely the result of the fixation of the assemblage point on its habitual place. The more rigid and stationary it is, the greater our confidence in ourselves, the greater our feeling of knowing the world, of being able to predict. What dreaming does is give us the fluidity to enter into other worlds by destroying our sense of knowing this world. Dreaming is a journey of unthinkable dimensions, a journey that, after making us perceive everything we can humanly perceive, makes the assemblage point jump outside the human domain and perceive the inconceivable. We are back again, harping on the most important topic of the sorcerer's world, the position of the assemblage point. The old sorcerer's curse, as well as mankind's thorn in the side. I say that because both mankind in general and the old sorcerers fell prey to the position of the assemblage point. Mankind, because by not knowing that the assemblage point exists, we are obliged to take the byproduct of its habitual position as something final and indisputable. And the old sorcerers, because although they knew all about the assemblage point, they fell for its faculty to be manipulated. You must avoid falling into those traps. Different worlds exist in the position of the assemblage point. You will have two choices. One, to follow mankind's rationalities and be faced with a predicament. Your experience will tell you that other worlds exist, but your reason will say that such worlds do not and cannot exist. The other, to follow the old sorcerer's rationalities, in which case you will automatically accept the existence of other worlds, and your greed alone will make your assemblage point hold on to the position that creates those worlds. The result would be another kind of predicament, that of having to move physically into vision-like realms, driven by expectations of power and gain. The dreaming emissary's voice is an impersonal but constant force from the realm of the inorganic beings. Thus, every dreamer experiences it in more or less the same terms. And if we choose to take its words as advice, we are incurable fools. My interest in telling you about the old sorcerers is not to badmouth them, but to pit them against you. Sooner or later, your assemblage point will be more fluid, but not fluid enough to offset the facility to be like them, righteous and hysterical. There is only one way to avoid all that. Sorcerers call it sheer understanding. I call it a romance with knowledge. It's the drive sorcerers use to know, to discover, to be bewildered. Seeing children's assemblage points constantly fluttering, as if moved by tremors, changing their place with ease, the old sorcerers came to the conclusion that the assemblage point's habitual location is not innate, but brought about by habituation. Seeing also that only in adults is it fixed on one spot, they surmised that the specific location of the assemblage point fosters a specific way of perceiving. Through usage, this specific way of perceiving becomes a system of interpreting sensory data. Since we are drafted into that system by being born into it, from the moment of our birth, we imperatively strive to adjust our perceiving to conform to the demands of this system, a system that rules us for life. Consequently, the old sorcerers were thoroughly right in believing that the act of countermanding it and perceiving energy directly is what transforms a person into a sorcerer. I am in wonder at the greatest accomplishment of our human upbringing, to lock our assemblage point on its habitual position, for once it is immobilized there, our perception can be coaxed and guided to interpret what we perceive. In other words, we can then be guided to perceive more in terms of our system than in terms of our senses. Human perception is universally homogeneous because the assemblage points of the whole human race are fixed on the same spot. Sorcerers prove all this to themselves when they see that at the moment the assemblage point is displaced beyond a certain threshold and new universal filaments of energy begin to be perceived, there is no sense to what we perceive. The immediate cause is that new sensory data has rendered our system inoperative. It can no longer be used to interpret what we are perceiving. Perceiving without our system is, of course, chaotic. But strangely enough, when we think we have truly lost our bearings, our old system rallies. It comes to our rescue and transforms our new incomprehensible perception into a thoroughly comprehensible new world, just like what happens to an apprentice when he gazes at the leaves of a tree and his dreaming attention comes forth. His perception is chaotic for a while. Everything comes to him at once, and his system for interpreting the world doesn't function. Then the chaos clears up, and there he is in front of a new world. That world exists in the precise position of his assemblage point at that moment. In order to perceive it, he needs cohesion. That is, he needs to maintain his assemblage point fixed on that position. The result is that he totally perceives a new world for a while. Others would perceive that same world if they had uniformity and cohesion. Uniformity and cohesion is to hold in unison the same position of the assemblage point. The old sorcerers called the entire act of acquiring uniformity and cohesion outside the normal world stalking perception. The art of stalking, as I've already said, deals with the fixation of the assemblage point. The old sorcerers discovered through practice that important as it is to displace the assemblage point, it is even more important to make it stay fixed on its new position, wherever that new position might be. If the assemblage point does not become stationary, there is no way that we can perceive coherently. We would experience then a kaleidoscope of disassociated images. This is the reason the old sorcerers put as much emphasis on dreaming as they did on stalking. One art cannot exist without the other, especially for the kinds of activities in which the old sorcerers were involved. The old sorcerers called them the intricacies of the second attention, or the grand adventure of the unknown. These activities stem from the displacements of the assemblage point. Not only had the old sorcerers learned to displace their assemblage points to thousands of positions on the surface or on the inside of their energy masses, but they had also learned to fixate their assemblage points on those positions and thus retain their cohesiveness indefinitely. We can't talk about the benefits of that. We can only talk about end results. The cohesiveness of the old sorcerers was such that it allowed them to become perceptually and physically everything the specific position of their assemblage points dictated. They could transform themselves into anything for which they had a specific inventory. An inventory is all the details of perception involved in becoming, for example, a jaguar, a bird, an insect, etc., etc. It is possible, not so much for you and me, but for them. For them, it was nothing. The old sorcerers had superb fluidity. All they needed was the slightest shift of their assemblage points, the slightest perceptual cue from their dreaming, and they would instantaneously stalk their perception, rearrange their cohesiveness to fit their new state of awareness, and be an animal, another person, a bird, or anything. Sorcerers bring order to the chaos. Their preconceived transcendental purpose is to free their perception. Sorcerers don't make up the world they are perceiving. They perceive energy directly, and then they discover that what they are perceiving is an unknown new world which can swallow them whole because it is as real as anything we know to be real. What happens as an apprentice gazes at the leaves of a tree is that initially he is perceiving the energy of the tree. On the subjective level, however, he believes he is dreaming because he employs dreaming techniques to perceive energy. To use dreaming techniques in the world of everyday life was one of the old sorcerer's most effective devices. It made perceiving energy directly dreamlike instead of totally chaotic, until a moment when something rearranged perception and the sorcerer found himself facing a new world. The scenery one views in that case is not a dream, nor is it our daily world. I've been saying this to you over and over, and you think that I'm merely repeating myself. I know how difficult it is for the mind to allow mindless possibilities to become real, but new worlds exist. They are wrapped one around the other, like the skins of an onion. The world we exist in is but one of those skins. So then, is the goal of my teaching to prepare you to go into those other worlds? No, I don't mean that. We go into those worlds only as an exercise. Those journeys are the antecedents of the sorcerers of today. We do the same dreaming that the old sorcerers used to do, but at one moment we deviate into new ground. The old sorcerers preferred the shifts of the assemblage point, so they were always on more or less predictable ground. We prefer the movements of the assemblage point. The old sorcerers were after the human unknown. We are after the non-human unknown. You haven't gotten to that yet. You are only beginning, and at the beginning everyone has to go through the old sorcerers' steps. After all, they were the ones who invented dreaming. When dreaming is too easy for you, it can be a damnation if you don't watch it. It leads to the human unknown. As I said to you, modern-day sorcerers strive to get to the non-human unknown, that is, freedom from being human. Inconceivable worlds that are outside the band of man, but that we still can perceive. This is where modern sorcerers take the side road. Their predilection is what's outside the human domain. And what are outside that domain are all-inclusive worlds, not merely the realm of birds or the realm of animals or the realm of man, even if it be the unknown man. What I am talking about are worlds, like the one where we live, total worlds with endless realms. Those worlds are in different positions of the assemblage point, but positions sorcerers arrive at with a movement of their assemblage point, not a shift. Entering into those worlds is the type of dreaming only sorcerers of today do. The old sorcerers stayed away from it because it requires a great deal of detachment and no self-importance whatsoever, a price they couldn't afford to pay. For the sorcerers who practice dreaming today, dreaming is freedom to perceive worlds beyond the imagination. Freedom is an adventure with no end, in which we risk our lives and much more for a few moments of something beyond words, beyond thoughts or feelings. What can be the driving force to do all this? To seek freedom is the only driving force I know. Freedom to fly off into that infinity out there. Freedom to dissolve, to lift off, to be like the flame of a candle, which, in spite of beating up against the light of a billion stars, remains intact, because it never pretended to be more than what it is, a mere candle. To suspend judgment and let the inorganic beings come was, in fact, the very procedure used by the sorcerers of antiquity to attract them. It is very difficult to make the self give up its strongholds except through practice. One of the self's strongest lines of defense is indeed our rationality, and this is not only the most durable line of defense when it comes to sorcery actions and explanations, but also the most threatened. The existence of inorganic beings is a foremost assailant of our rationality. From time to time, a projection from the realm of the inorganic beings, a current of foreign energy, a scout, will be injected into your dreams. So, after you've crossed the first gate of dreaming, adjust your dreaming attention and be on the alert. Scouts are more numerous when our dreams are average, normal ones. The dreams of dreamers are strangely free from scouts. When they appear, they are identifiable by the strangeness and incongruity surrounding them. Their presence doesn't make any sense. Only in average dreams are things nonsensical. I would say that this is so because more scouts are injected then, because average people are subject to a greater barrage from the unknown. In my opinion, what takes place is a balance of forces. Average people have stupendously strong barriers to protect themselves against those onslaughts, barriers such as worries about the self. The stronger the barrier, the greater the attack. Dreamers, by contrast, have fewer barriers and fewer scouts in their dreams. It seems that in dreamers' dreams, nonsensical things disappear, perhaps to ensure that dreamers catch the presence of scouts. In dreaming, some items are of key importance because they are associated with the spirit. Others are entirely unimportant by reason of being associated with our indulging personality. The first scout you isolate will always be present in any form. Incongruous items are foreign invaders of our dreams. Upon isolating them, your dreaming attention always focuses on them with an intensity that does not occur under any other circumstances. At that point in your dreaming, scouts are reconnoiters sent by the inorganic realm. They are very fast, meaning that they don't stay long. They come in search of potential awareness. They have consciousness and purpose, although it is incomprehensible to our minds, comparable perhaps to the consciousness and purpose of trees. The inner speed of trees and inorganic beings is incomprehensible to us because it is infinitely slower than ours. Both trees and inorganic beings last longer than we do. They are made to stay put. They are immobile, yet they make everything move around them. Inorganic beings are stationary like trees. What one sees in dreaming as bright or dark sticks are their projections. What one hears as the voice of the dreaming emissary is equally their projection. And so are their scouts. Trees also have projections like that. Their projections are, however, even less friendly to us than those of the inorganic beings. Dreamers never seek them unless they are in a state of profound amenity with trees, which is a very difficult state to attain. Remember, the realm of inorganic beings was the old sorcerer's field. To get there, they tenaciously fixed their dreaming attention on the items of their dreams. In that fashion, they were able to isolate the scouts, and when they had the scouts in focus, they voiced their intent to follow them. The instant the old sorcerers voiced that intent, off they went, pulled by that foreign energy. Only follow the dreaming emissary's guidance when it refers to dreaming. The dreaming attention comes from behind the roof of the mouth. Feel in dreaming that you are pressing the roof of your mouth with the tip of your tongue. By living up to my standards of self-examination with no indulgence, the emissary's voice and what it says will become a super challenge for you. You have to avoid at all costs succumbing to the temptation of the emissary's promise of knowledge, and you have to do this all by yourself. The diabolical nature of the inorganic being's realm is that it might very well be the only sanctuary dreamers have in a hostile universe. It really is a haven for some dreamers. Not for me. I don't need props or railings. I know what I am. I am alone in a hostile universe, and I have learned to say, so be it. Under the influence of dreaming, reality suffers a metamorphosis. Two options are faced by all dreamers. Either we carefully revamp or we completely disregard our system of sensory input interpretation. To revamp our interpretation system means to intend its reconditioning. It means that one deliberately and carefully attempts to enlarge its capabilities. By living in accordance with the sorcerer's way, dreamers save and store the necessary energy to suspend judgment and thus facilitate that intended revamping. If we choose to recondition our interpretation system, reality becomes fluid and the scope of what can be real is enhanced without endangering the integrity of reality. Dreaming then indeed opens the door into other aspects of what is real. If we choose to disregard our system, the scope of what can be perceived without interpretation grows inordinately. The expansion of our perception is so gigantic that we are left with very few tools for sensory interpretation and thus a sense of an infinite realness that is unreal or an infinite unrealness that could very well be real but is not. The existence of inorganic beings is the foremost assailant of our rationality. Only after you have really suspended judgment will you get any relief. An apprentice's energy level, which steadily grows, one day reaches a threshold that allows him to disregard assumptions and prejudgments about the nature of man, reality, and perception. That day he becomes enamored with knowledge, regardless of logic or functional value, and above all, regardless of personal convenience. The inorganic beings are after our awareness. They'll give us knowledge, but they'll extract a payment, our total being. Inorganic beings can't force anyone to stay with them. To live in their world is a voluntary affair. Yet they are capable of imprisoning any one of us by catering to our desires, by pampering and indulging us. Beware of awareness that is immobile. Awareness like that has to seek movement, and it does this, as I've told you, by creating projections, phantasmagorical projections at times. Inorganic beings hook onto dreamers' innermost feelings and play them mercilessly. They create phantoms to please dreamers or frighten them. Inorganic beings are superb projectionists who delight in projecting themselves like pictures on the wall. The old sorcerers portrayed the inorganic being's world as a blob of caverns and pores floating in some dark space, and they portrayed the inorganic beings as hollow canes bound together like the cells of our bodies. Every dreamer sees the world in the same terms, as it is. The inorganic beings create for dreamers the sense of being unique, exclusive, plus a more pernicious sense yet, the sense of having power. Power and uniqueness are unbeatable as corrupting forces. Watch out. You can avoid that danger by going to that world a few times and then never going back. In the opinion of sorcerers, the universe is predatorial, and sorcerers more than anyone else have to take this into account in their daily sorcery activities. Consciousness is intrinsically compelled to grow, and the only way it can grow is through strife, through life or death confrontations.